Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Last week, a federal judge overturned the conviction of Brendan Dassey. You might recognize the name of the teen who was featured in the hit Netflix documentary Making a Murder. In that show, Dassey confessed to participating in a rape and a murder with his uncle in a small Wisconsin town. Dassey and his uncle, Stephen Avery, are now both in prison for that murder. The judge said that investigators obtained the confession by making false promises to Dassey and telling him he had nothing to worry about. We'll start the hour by listening to part of the conversation I had with Laura Nyreiter back in February. She's the project director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth at Northwestern University, and here's what she told me about Dassey's confession.
Well, Stephen Avery had actually been arrested shortly after Teresa Halbach went missing, and he had been arrested 4 months before the police turned to Brendan as a suspect in this case. And so the investigation had been unfolding against Stephen Avery for 4 months, and it wasn't yielding the kinds of answers that the police were looking for, answers about what happened to Ms. Halbach in the last few hours of her life. And so they turned to people close to Stephen to try to get them to speak about things he may have told them. They tried first with Stephen's fiancée, Jody Stachowski. They questioned her at the police station, but she wasn't giving them any information. They were getting nowhere with her. So they turned to Brendan Dassey. That's Stephen's 16-year-old, intellectually limited nephew, who was actually questioned 4 times over the course of 48 hours, the 48-hour period immediately preceding the interrogation that we saw on Making a Murderer. So what you see in the film is, in the series, is the culmination of the fourth time Brendan's been questioned over 48 hours.
Is it important to note that there is no lawyer for Brendan present? I got the sense that his mother also did not really know what was happening with her son, that he was being questioned as frequently as he was.
Well, you're exactly right. When the interrogators called Brendan's mother on March 1st and told her that they wanted to speak to him, they did not tell her why, which seems to be an important part of the story. If any parent out there, I think, would have, you know, an immediate instinct, if the police want to speak to my child, I want to know why. But the police did not tell Brendan's mother why they were interested in Brendan. They did not tell her that he was a suspect in a sexual assault in a murder case. Instead, they just said, we want to talk to him. And without that information, she agreed. She allowed Brendan to be questioned without her present and without an attorney present. You're exactly right that he was unrepresented during that interrogation. And we can see the results, a confession that is unreliable and false.
Laura, was his mother asked if she wanted to call a lawyer, or did she explicitly waive the right to have a lawyer in the room, or was that not really explained to her?
That was never explained to her. So she was never waiving any rights on behalf of Brendan, never was invited to have an attorney present.
You mentioned a moment ago that I think you said he's intellectually challenged. He has a lower than average IQ. Why is that important to understand?
Well, it's important to understand because in the context of interrogation, people being interrogated are making life-altering decisions about the things they say to police, right? What you say when you're in that interrogation room can quite literally end your life in some states and result in a life sentence, as it did for Brendan in other states. And to make those kinds of judgments, especially without the aid of a lawyer or a parent for somebody like Brendan, is too consequential. And you can imagine for somebody with intellectual limitations who may not understand what's at stake in making those kinds of decisions, whether to speak to the police, whether to invoke one's Miranda rights, that's a huge disadvantage.
Would a lawyer have been able to stop this interrogation from happening, or would a lawyer have tried to stop some of the specific questions that were being asked in these interrogations from being answered?
Well, a lawyer could have done both those things, depending on what the lawyer decided was the appropriate path to take. But you're exactly right that what would have made a difference for Brendan would have been an opportunity, at least, to have a meaningful consultation with an attorney who could have advised him whether to proceed with questioning, whether to answer the kinds of questions he was being asked, or whether to terminate the interview altogether.
Here's another part of one of the interrogation sessions, and the interrogators are starting to get some details from Brendan. Let's listen.
Why did he have you come over there? Did he need help with something? Remember, we already know, but we need to hear it from you.
How important is that last part, Laura? We remember we already know, but we need to hear it from you.
Well, it's absolutely critical, and I'm glad you picked out that clip. To understand why Brendan confessed, you have to understand the way that police interrogations work, okay? And it follows a very specific pattern in almost all cases. Officers come into the interrogation room. They confront the witness with their firm belief that that person is guilty. They confront the person with evidence, either real or manufactured, of their guilt, and they convince that person that there is no way that that person is going to convince the officers that they're innocent. And once someone in Brendan's position is reduced down to a sense of hopelessness, you know, there's no way I'm going to be able to convince these officers that I didn't do it, the officers offer an incentive. They say something just like what we just heard. Look, we already know what happened, and it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. We just need to hear it from you. And under the influence of those kinds of statements, officers get confessions from all kinds of suspects. But the problem with somebody like Brendan, of course, is when he heard the officers saying, we already know it's going to be okay, just tell us what happened, we just need to hear it from you, you know, people can too easily think, okay, these officers are saying it's going to be okay. I guess I'll just agree to what they want me to say. And, of course, it's not actually okay in the end.
I want to make sure we say that the techniques that the interrogators used that you've just described are all within their rights to use. They are allowed to come in and act like they know more than they know. They're allowed to lie, aren't they, to the person that they're interrogating?
It is currently legal for officers to lie to suspects during interrogations about the kind of evidence that is against the suspects. So, for example, an officer could come into an interrogation room and say, look, we found your fingerprints on the gun, when that's a lie. That is legal. It's a decades-old Supreme Court case that has held that to be true. Of course, with the changing knowledge, changing awareness in the world, and really in the past 10 years concerning false confessions, concerning the way that deception during interrogations can influence people, especially kids like Brendan, can actually be a risk factor for false confessions. We're hopeful that that law is going to change soon.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the way you said that, currently legal. Now, why would that law change? And would it only change for juvenile defendants? Or do you think, given all the questions about confessions overall, you have a good shot of getting that taken away?
Well, I think it should change, frankly, for everybody, but certainly for juveniles like Brendan. And what's interesting is, you know, there's a company out there that developed and markets the most widely used interrogation technique in the country. It's called John E. Reed and Associates, and it's based here in Chicago. And they actually agree that with juvenile suspects, deception should not be used. So here you've got the folks who developed the interrogation techniques, who train most police officers around the country how to interrogate. It's the most widely used technique in the country. And they're agreeing, look, we shouldn't be saying things like we already know when it's a lie. We shouldn't be using deception, especially with juveniles like Brendan. And I think with that kind of consensus, you know, the law's got to catch up.
Laura Nyreiter is with us. If you've just tuned in, she's project director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth, and she has been involved in this case that a lot of Americans know about now because they've been watching this Netflix series called Making a Murder. We are focused today specifically on the issues around confessions and juvenile defendants. If you watch the series, you see some of this tape, and I watched hours of tape over the last week or so of this interrogation of Brendan Dassey, then 16 years old, believed by police to have been involved in a rape and murder that his uncle, Stephen Avery, is accused of. Both of them are now in prison. For all intents and purposes, it appears that Brendan Dassey is confessing to a crime that he has knowledge of. And you're hearing some of the ideas that the criminal justice system and that attorneys like Laura are thinking about as they watch those interrogation tapes and get involved in this case. Delora in Duluth. Hey, Laura. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, interesting topic. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
So I had a comment about this. Being that I work for a child advocacy center, oftentimes what I noticed from watching the documentary as well is that Brendan Dassey was interviewed as a witness initially and not as a suspect. And so there are many, many problems that I see just being a forensic interviewer with the approach that they took with interviewing this child on school, not a neutral environment, obviously, and then changing it into an incriminating statements with him and not using tactics in the interview which would elicit more narrative, which is actually much more forensically sound and reliable statements from Brendan Dassey. So what I've seen differently handled is that when we interview kids at a child advocacy center, which we're developing more of through the Minnesota Children's Alliance in the state of Minnesota here, thankfully, is that when you bring them to a neutral environment with a professional forensic interviewer and not a law enforcement person, if the children start being making incriminating statements, that is a different interview then and at that point, but that we would still continue just to get the information as a witness from them in a non-suggestive way. So with the interview that we watched, the tactics that the law enforcement investigators used with Brendan Dassey, we saw how all of a sudden they're starting to ask a lot of yes-no questions, right, or what we call suggestive or leading questioning. So the questioning style as a forensic interviewer I had a lot of issues with and was very concerned about how it was conducted.
So Laura, to our caller, Laura, can you see the time or the moment when it's clear that Brendan has turned into a suspect and is no longer being interviewed as a witness? Or do you think that was the case from the beginning?
Well, I think Brendan started out as a witness at the beginning of those four questioning sessions that happened over the 48 hours preceding March 1st. But you can tell, your caller is exactly right. The way that the interrogators were asking him questions, were using leading questions that suggest the answer that they were looking for, over time, he began sensing, I think, that they were looking for those kinds of responses from him. And he turned from a witness to a suspect because he was incorporating that information into his statements. So it's sort of a feedback loop, if you can imagine this. They ask leading questions. He incorporates that information into his statements. They think, aha, you know, he does know something. And it just keeps going and going and going over the course of four questioning sessions.
Northwestern University law professor Laura Nyrider talking to me earlier this year about the case of Brendan Dassey. A federal judge in Milwaukee has now overturned Dassey's conviction and ordered him released within 90 days unless prosecutors choose to seek a new trial.